see if you had some recollection of.
Right, again, it's 14 years, it's hard to remember some of those things. But most of the things that I've tried to remark about the last couple of days, I think was certainly consistent with self-determination and control. But recall that the thing that I kept emphasizing was the what I think was the Congress's idea that that self-determination didn't mean insularity, and it didn't mean necessarily permanence and endless trusteeship arrangements or wardship arrangements or overlordship arrangements, that it really was self-determination that could go in any direction, that that's what alienation idea was dreamed up for, so that using the private corporation notion, people could go do what they wanted to do after some 20 whatever year period the Congress decided. So in that sense, I think the self-determination and kind of de-emphasizing differences and emphasizing sameness was what did surround the act.
Thank you for joining us after the great events taking place earlier today.
Yeah, I've been busy. Thank you for letting me come back, and I apologize for not hearing what was said earlier, but as you know, I've had some preoccupations. I just wanted to add one note to this discussion, and that is that certainly there was some discussion. I don't think it was the intent of the state in particular, but there was discussion about this being a capitalist settlement. And just as the Allotment Act contemplated in some senses the conversion of American Indians into small farmers, there was no doubt that there was some fond hopes on the part of maybe members of the Congress that this act was going to turn Alaskan natives into capitalist businessmen. And you know, maybe that worked to a point, I don't know. But I think that certainly was there, and some people were devoted to that proposition, particularly in the Congress, talking about you know, people, Republican from Pennsylvania, something like that, you know, that who would have that kind of objective as part of their objectives. I don't think those of us in Alaska were thinking about it that much. So the form itself presupposes a certain amount of determinism that runs against the grain of what you think of socially as being a, or in the ordinary meaning of the word, of self-determination. If you buy into a whole lot of things with a form.
Next question.
Right.
Oh, just Mr. Borbridge, sorry.
I want to intrude myself because while you gentlemen are talking theory, I'd like to tell you what actually happened in respect to one facet of this. Firstly, and this will have a bearing, Mr. Chairman, on this question. During this time, as we discuss it, a lot of things were happening. Not everything was just focused solely on the Claims Settlement Act. Some of you remember President Nixon's message to the Indians, and you remember that there was increasing emphasis, regardless of, you know, of what we may think of how the terms or the rhetoric of the message was carried forward. There was an emphasis and a desire in the administration to do something, which was translated into this discussion we're having about self-determination. There's mention by Mr. Jones that there was a hope that possibly the opportunities offered through ANCSA might bring a melting pot concept more into being, that the newly emerged capitalists coming in from rural Alaska would somehow be fitting into this flow of history theme with all of its overwhelming pressures. Specifically at this time, the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indians of Alaska, of which I was a member and which I had the privilege of serving as president, was presenting itself and recognized as a tribal governing body. We considered that theoretically, while the roots for the assertion of this status was derived from a long history to which I alluded the other day, we felt that the culmination of our efforts to be recognized for what we had been for a long time, a tribal governing body, had pretty much reached its climax with the recognition and enactment of legislation which the Tlingit N'haidas proposed to the Congress, which legislation proposed methods for the use of the Tlingit N'haida judgment funds. We not only proceeded, once the legislation was enacted, to implement the terms of the legislatively or congressionally approved plans developed by the people themselves, acting through their committees and their convention, but we, in fact, began to expand on the notion that we could act in a more powerful, assertive role by being a stronger tribal government. See, there seems to be here a hint or a suggestion that a tribal governing body, if it associates too much with these Western institutions, might itself become a Western instrument and thus become alien to the very people who spawned it and who seized history to use it. But instead, in our instance, we used the tribal governing body by challenging the administration, specifically through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to start to spell out some of the broad thrust of what President Nixon enunciated in his Indian message, the chief thrust of which we saw that was useful to us was the emphasis on self-determination. One of the first steps we took, therefore, was to begin negotiations to take over the operation of the Southeast BIA agency. We began negotiations on the Southeast level. We encountered, predictably, the opposition of the entrenched people who, if we were successful in our efforts to contract, would be removed or transferred and replaced by people appointed by the tribe itself. We were successful in the negotiations, and that is evident today. We also began successful efforts to contract for the administration of education funds which previously had been administered by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We began to administer those under a contract. We also began to investigate possibilities for being involved in housing, for considering a credit union, and we also began to initiate other efforts. The point I'm emphasizing here is that there was no splitting off whatsoever from our sense of tribalism. We, by acting through our tribal status and by moving into these programs and using what was available to us through presidential announcement and through programs in the Congress and this emphasis on self-determination, we began as a result to become much stronger as a tribe. By doing for ourselves, which is the overall thrust of what we did through the contracting efforts we made, we in fact were exercising the strongest possible method of practicing self-determination. We, instead of depending on others to make judgments for us, were able to have our own people involved who understood more about us, had better insight about our concerns, our aspirations, and we considered that this was spelling out this whole concept of self-determination. I think this also partially assures some of us who were considering sovereignty as somehow a largely undefined theory. And even I may have suggested that, but at least in one instance it was being spelled out. The notion I had an opportunity to advance because I had the privilege of speaking for the Tlingit and Haidas was that we considered the status under which we functioned as a tribal governing body and the opportunities to strengthen ourselves. And I consider that Mr. Yupiksen's reference to how they analyzed their situation and began to respond to it using tools or developing even innovative tools is again much in that line. So there was a tribal governing body. It was active, it was functioning, it was contracting, and it is no less a tribal governing body. It is even more of a tribal governing body than it was before it began to exercise the initiative to undertake these various tasks which previously were done by others for our good or our well-being. I just want to put this perspective in that we were doing what we were, what I hear was talked about here, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Borbridge. We'll ask Mr. Case for his next question then.
I feel like I'm on What's My Line. Well, finally, there's been a fair, well, almost, I think, unanimous agreement that one of the major difficulties with the Claims Act as it's viewed today is the position of the later-born children. And I guess the question that's in view of your perspective on the social policy angle of developing the Claims Act or social engineering, whatever, what, if you recall, was the purpose in crafting the Claims Act to limit shareholders, or certainly in retrospect the largest majority of shareholders, to those who were born on or before December 18, 1971?
Yes, David. I, again, don't remember that with great clarity. My recollection was, though, that the committee was looking around for the choosing someday and did not want to leave it open-ended, I think was one thrust. It did not want to leave it open-ended. And you could decide on one generation's worth or two generations' worth, or you could do what I think was most immediate and most, or was at least defensible at the time, and that is choose a date certain, and the date certain, as is often chosen in legislative acts, is the date of the passage of the act. So it was, you can look backwards and with legislation and do grandfathering of various kinds, and you can look forward and set future dates. I think the Congress was just rather pragmatic about it, not wanting to leave it open, and it just chose a date certain, and that was the date of settlement. I don't think that there were, and I certainly don't remember, great deep-seated raging struggles over that choice.
Why not leave it open-ended? Were there considerations given to leaving it open-ended? And otherwise?
The best I could do on that, David, in recollection, was that I think the worry that about open-endedness was only to do with whether the numbers might get, the dollar amounts, the size of the settlement and so on might get larger somehow, and not, I don't think the Congress would be concerned, I don't think the Congress was very concerned as long as it didn't mean a larger settlement in some fashion or another. Do you remember that more clearly?
One other. I may be singing from the same songbook on a lot of these, but with regard to a lot of these kinds of questions, I think the answer still is that you're going to find substantial, and this was my difference with Dave earlier, substantial work done by some of the interested entities, whether it was academic work, whether it was the natives, themselves. You will probably find some history with regard to these events, but with regard to this one, like some of the others I mentioned earlier, I think you're going to find perilously little conversation about it in the actual consideration of the legislation. In the case of the cutoff date for afterborns, others may have different recollections. I recall that coming up basically in the context of what I would call the sort of the bean counters from BIA and the Bureau of the Budget and others who were concerned about enrollment. And on regular occasions during the consideration of this act, there were concerns raised, sometimes in sort of highly veiled forms, but basically what people were saying is they were worried about cheating on enrollment and mistakes on enrollment and explosion of the enrollment rolls of people entitled to benefits under the act, people who are concerned about the way in which proportionality between the regions would be maintained, where you used a population base as the criterion for dividing certain benefits under the act. And as a result of that, there was some pressure on Congress in the absence of great concern. I mean, I don't remember anybody in the delegation being greatly concerned about this. And in the absence of some pressing social or philosophical or policy concern on the part of Congress, the administration pressed for some kind of certainty with regard to the enrollment and for some kind of certainty with regard to a cutoff date. And one was added.
Mr. Hickok and then Mr.
I think there's a lot to that. There was nothing about that date prior to the 1970 dialogue. And it came about in two ways. My memory is very much the same as Guy's, although I think nothing is better than some research on these things. And there is a written record, as you point out, on a lot of these. But it came about both from administrative demands and from the aspect that this was compensation of the time, of that moment in time. Those two things, I think.
Mr. Havlock?
I do remember discussing with the delegation the administrative complexity that would be involved in leaving a permanently open enrollment, and the remembering that that one of the functions of the settlement, as David just saying, was to terminate or to make the settlement end as of then. We were setting up a system of state-based corporations. If we left an open enrollment, you would have had a continuing set of rights based upon federal statute, and one of the things that was intended to do was to break it loose from the from a basis of right in federal law. Also, we were looking at the again as a part of that, looking at the free alienability stock down the road when having a permanently open class would lose its meaning entirely, and there was discussion about the possible problems of people being disenfranchised in a sense, but it was thought that it would be taken care of for the most part by inheritance, and that in 91 it would become a moot issue.
Yes. Did you have another question, Mr. Case? No. Rosita Worrell, do you have some questions?
I'll limit my questions to two questions. During the first few days of the hearings and the record of the early ANCSA hearings, we heard that Native people had a very grave concern about control over their land. And it was the desire for control as well as the fear of BIA oversight, which led them to reject IRAs and to go with corporations. Mr. Jones has indicated that normalcy or equal treatment, or perhaps what social theorists would call economic assimilation, was the objective of many congressmen and ANCSA. this normalcy or economic assimilation was to be accomplished through corporations. But yet we had, at this period in time, already had the experience of corporations with the Menominee and then later on with the Klamath Indians. And under this experience, we see that normalcy or economic assimilation was not accomplished. We saw instead a transfer of vast timber assets transferred from Indian ownership to non-Indian ownership. The question I have is not really the contradiction between what the natives wanted and what Congress wanted, but really what I'm asking is perhaps Professor Jones and maybe Mr. Martin could explain to us the contradiction that I see between the ANCSA assimilationist objectives and also the objectives expressed in other federal Indian policy, which states that cultural pluralism is a policy of the United States. And I think we've heard John Borbridge talk about President Nixon's statement on self-determination or the rights for Indians to maintain themselves as tribal entities. We also have the National Environmental Policy Act that, for the first time in legislative history, it says that, you know, rather than looking only at economic costs, cost benefits of development, that we would also consider cultural benefits. And under that act, we see the protection of many cultural societies whose economies are based on subsistence hunting. So I guess I'd like to have them maybe comment on this contradiction between two policies.
I think it's well to have other people. Yes, Guy Martin. Let me suggest some other people comment on that, because I don't think that's anywhere close to the exclusive province of someone who sat on a staff at the time. I think, in part, I've already given my answer, and that is that the reason that you do not see those policies that you articulated appearing as clearly in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is because the act, as I experienced in any event, did not start out with the slightest intention of being that sort of law in the eyes of most people, although I'm certainly willing to stipulate that there were lots of people who were involved in the debate who had policy objectives and some who pursued them throughout the legislation. Most people never pursued it with the idea that it was to be an important cultural and social act in the way that some of the others you named were. There was an acknowledgement by some that what we were addressing was, as some people suggested, a matter of truth and justice. There were some people who felt strongly about that. For some, there was a sort of a passing acknowledgement of that as a basis to proceed and to give political justification to the act. For other people, it was simply enough to know that the Trans-Alaska Pipeline couldn't be built unless the claims were settled. For others, it was enough to understand that they ought to seriously consider the issue of settlement, and if that didn't work, then find another way to build a pipeline. And I think people were spread out over that terrain fairly broadly. When that was reflected in the act, as I saw it, maybe I should say one other thing. That sounds a little crasser and crueler than I would want it to be. I think most people clearly approach it from the standpoint of righting a wrong and satisfying something they saw as a claim which, for one reason or another, simply had to be settled. I think that there were fewer people spread out over that sort of more cynical spectrum. But nevertheless, however they got there, I don't believe that Congress, at least, believed that it had been asked to pronounce important social and cultural policy. I believe that it had been asked to settle an Indian land claim, and they proceeded to do that. And as the act unfolded over these, really over about a three-year period of intensive activity, and over that final intensive year in which the act was passed, the discussions that were held, both the discussions at the committee level, the discussions between the various interests, particularly the natives and the Alaska delegation, and I'm sure that the discussion of the various interests and their own council turned almost exclusively on a kind of a bargaining model, in the sense that people were really trying to figure out how much they could get and how much they had to give in order to settle this matter, and that relatively little discussion was given to the issue of which social and cultural injustices this would write, or what policy would set for the future. Not, as a final word, to say that those issues were ignored. People talked about effects a great deal, and people talked about what would happen if different courses were followed. But I can't stress strongly enough how much it occurred to me, at least, to be essentially an economic and legal settlement of a claim.
Rosita, my recollection of that is quite consistent with Guy's, but a couple other things I think are worth saying on it. Legislative acts, of course, don't have to be single-purpose, single-minded. They generally have a major primary purpose, but while you're at it, you try to accomplish some other things. Another thing that I once was involved in here in Alaska was the post-earthquake period. Now, and there's an analogy here, so it isn't much of a digression, if you will. But the point is that when the United States government came to grapple with, together with the state of Alaska, the rehabilitation of Alaska, as it was called, after the earthquake, it's almost certain that we overdid it. Overdid it in the sense that if you said that all you were trying to do was to reconstruct things and get things back to just what they were the day before Good Friday 1964, that you would have done it quite differently than what we, now is the United States government and the state of Alaska, public policy, we probably wouldn't have done anywhere near as much as what was in fact done. In other words, that's what I mean by overdoing it. We say, well, here's a very serious thing, a major disaster, and the United States government is pretty good about responding to major disasters, I think, and indeed it sees it usually as an occasion to over-respond. Over-respond not just because there's political pressure to do so and that there's sympathy to do so, but that you may find there's an occasion that's just exactly the right thing to do. What I have in mind in this case is that the state of Alaska had only been a state, years or so, at that time. And as tricky as it is to create a new state in the United States politically, it's still trickier to create one fiscally, financially. And so it was seen that while we were doing the right thing of rehabilitating Alaska after the earthquake and the immediate post-disaster period, here was the opportunity to go ahead and do a whole bunch of things you otherwise wouldn't do, to try to make that forward thrust of economic development, which was so primary in everyone's mind at the time. Well, I think the analogy here is not perfect, but there's something to it, that at least political economists, maybe the attorneys were a little more precise on this than the rest, but political economists anyway, and staffers of other stripes, had in mind that that's right, here's a legal claim that you want to extinguish once and for all, but while we're doing it with these elements and components of the settlement, wouldn't it be smart to go ahead and try to look to the longer term economic development, frankly, this particular portion of the Alaska citizenry. So I would never want to claim that it was a primary objective. I agree with Guy certainly on that, but I would claim that it was a major secondary objective. On the matter of what about environmentalism and other concerns that we now see, not everything is explainable in the context of the times. It's a temptation always to do that. But recall, in the 60s, it really was a theme of upward mobility and reducing economic barriers to upward mobility and the economic development theme. And this was so in black America as well. And not too many years after that, I think in the black citizenry of the United States has had a reversion toward interest in differentness and the black studies programs and so on and so on. Well, fine. But it was not the themes of the 60s, in my view. in black America, and it changed over. Well, I think perhaps here we weren't wrestling with the environmental and cultural concerns. They were not center stage. It's hard for government to focus on very many things at one time, I think.
Mr. Havlick.
I think I could hear Doug maybe establishing some distance from Guy's position there in a way, and it seems to me that there may be, with respect to the social and cultural aspects, that maybe there was more of a congressional view that it was simply settling a claim, but it certainly would not have been the position of most of the state people, in the sense of the state, anybody involved with the state was aware of the impact that this was going to have in Alaska, that that economic impacts were going to have a lot to say about culture and everything else going on. So, and that expressed itself in things like, for example, 7I, which the Alaska Natives had an interest in terms of the sharing of the pot, but state of Alaska had an interest in it from the point of view of not of attempting to do whatever could be done within the context of the need for a consensual agreement to spread the revenue so that you would not have more extremes of wealth than would be inevitable within a consensual basis. From the perspective of the Congress also, one of the things I ran into on more than one occasion, maybe you talked about it earlier, is that for many of the congressmen, it was leftover business from the Statehood Act, a provision that said it left the thing to be settled. And during the statehood battle, there had been arguments made that Alaska was not ready for statehood and statehood should not come because this settlement act, because the settlement of the claim was not included in that statehood act. So I can remember that. One congressman in particular shaking his finger at the governor and saying, I told you, Bill, that you're going to have to come back and do this and that we should have done taken care of it at the time. Might add, if they had taken care of it at the time, it would have been, quantitatively, it would have been a small fraction of the settlement and probably wouldn't have, it would have meant a settlement that would have to have been opened up again with a lot of bitterness later on.
Rosita, next question.
This one is for Fred Paul. This morning you suggested that there's a difference between BIA oversight over IRAs when federal money and when private money is used. As I recall, you said that BIA has substantial oversight over IRAs when federal funds are utilized and that the BIA doesn't have oversight when private money, or you were, I guess, referencing the possibility of private assets from Native corporations. In your opinion, would, if, and as you said this morning, that in that instance, when private funds are utilized, then BIA doesn't have oversight. The question is, if they don't have BIA oversight, is the trust protection in place?
Yes, the government does not have federal oversight with respect to borrowing money from outside sources. You can compare it with a banker. When the federal government is the banker, the federal government is looking over your shoulder to see how you spend the money. And that's what the BIA did in the Canby situation, the boat loan situation. And in my judgment, that's the basic fault of the failure of the IRA business enterprises in Southeast and also in the stores to the westward. You would still have the trust concept. For example, you'd have sovereign immunity from lawsuits, which is your basic trust protection. On land, you, because of sovereign immunity, and if it's acquired in certain fashions, you'd still have protection from invading your land base. I should mention that there were 62 IRAs as of 1940. And
in Alaska or in the country?
In Alaska. And I believe there are about 10 traditional councils, which is the amorphous form of an IRA. It's not as structured, but it has about the same legal capacity. Beyond that, I don't know what trust you have to consider trust responsibilities with respect to a particular thing. Those are the two that I have in mind.
Excuse me, Mr. Paul. Immunity from suit and immunity from federal income tax flow from the trust relationship. You say that even absent federal oversight, where an undertaking is being carried out with private funds, those two characteristics continue in force.
That's right, unless waived. Now, maybe in order to borrow money, you got to waive it, but that's your choice. It's still available. Sovereign immunity can be waived by an IRA.
And is there any accepted legal opinion as to whether or not state income tax can be imposed on a on an IRA or by an IRA chartered corporation?
Not in Alaska, of course, because we don't have an income tax up here, state income tax, and I'm unacquainted with any in the lower 48. The state does impose state business licenses on the IRAs up here, but I believe that was because of default. In other words, the IRAs engaging in business, now I'm speaking of these stores to the westward, what I call ANICA, Alaska Native Industries Cooperative Association, they have about 50 stores that they supply merchandise for every year. I expressed disappointment that there wasn't a contest, but there wasn't, and so there it is.
I see, yes. Did you want to comment, Mr. Jones? No. Did you want to comment, Mr. Case, on Mr. Paul's answer?
No, I don't. Thank you.
I had some other thoughts I wanted to express.
Well, go ahead.
Thank you. With respect to our general discussion as to why we have ANCSA at all, part of it is Alaska has been plagued with what I call social do-gooders. We have had so many PhDs up here who in the space of 1 month can identify the problems, and another 30 days they can supply the answers. To some extent, that is true of congressmen. They are in a position of power. They have the vote, the voice and the votes. It is their authority which enacts laws. And many of them try to do social good. And as a byproduct, sometimes they miss the boat. Certainly it is true of staff. I know that the youngsters we had helping Justice Goldberg exercised enormous power and did much of the drafting. I'm sure that that was true of the congressional staff. They have their idea of social justice. Doug Jones said that one of the thoughts that was prevalent back there was amalgamation. Certainly amalgamation was in the mind of Senator Jackson. Assimilation.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Same thing. We're going to have, as Doug put it a little while ago, we're going to have an end product of one people. That is, of course, the very antithesis of self-determination. I don't share that criticism of the Alaska Native Review Commission, however. The commissioners had vast experience over 16, 17 years that I know of, and has fought very seriously for the rights of the Aborigines of Canada, and so I'm not classifying this commissioner with the, what I call the do-gooders. An example of imposing or suggesting, maybe not imposing, suggesting do-gooding is expressing an opinion that the IRA is not a suitable vehicle. I've thrown out this question in my presentation this morning, and nobody's answered it yet. What's wrong with it? I don't share Doug Jones's criticism that it's wrong to have several layers or several different routes, is the way he put it. The IRA route, the borough route, the settlement corporation route. I see nothing wrong with that. Each of them performs different functions. And they can walk down the road arm in arm. There's a little confusion about it as to which agency should have jurisdiction over some particular social function, but those things will be ironed out. I surely would get back to my question, why isn't IRA a proper vehicle today? Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Parker.
Mr. Paul asked me that question earlier, and I guess the time has come to reply. The difference is visualizing the RIA as one avenue is very different from that which has been proposed by some as viewing it as perhaps the primary or only avenue for solving some of the problems that are arising from ANCSCA. So I think that I would stand by my original contention that it is not the best avenue at this time in history. Some villages, some tribes may find it one of the options they wish to exercise, and it may work well for them. I am not sure whether, you know, the community of Metlakatla has become such a viable and well-functioning community because of or in spite of the IRA. I don't know Metlakatla that well. I know it pretty well, and I do know it, you know, that it functions very well as a community, but I have always attributed that to the ability of that people as to function as a community and a very enterprising community and utilizing the resources of southeastern Alaska in the seas and land. I think many of the points that have been made around the table this afternoon are absolutely critical. In an earlier conversation with David Case, he asked me why I expressed my antipathy towards Justice Marshall yesterday and the route upon which he set the United States. I would say, in crystallizing that a little more than we did in our earlier conversation, it is because the tribe does not need the recognition of any particular Western institution to exist. The tribe exists. The village exists. And it is for the convenience of Western institutions, primarily Western governmental and legal institutions, that we go through all this. In order to continue to exist, obviously, the tribe requires some geographical expression, some land base. And securing that land base, of course, was what we've all talked about, and how to continue to secure it in the future has been many of the options I tried to bring out on the paper, and many other people have taken up here today. But remembering what, you know, the ultimate goal of ANCSCA as an economic, as a partial economic solution to long-term problems should not, you know, make it the final and end all. And I think it's been very aptly and correctly brought out that in the ideal world, each tribe, each community, if it has a state and federal government which are operating in the way they should, is going to be helpful in ensuring that it is able to seek out those options that serve it best. And that's why I think that, in essence, those institutions which lend themselves best to that, in essence, probably not trust institutions, but institutions which have reasonable long-term firm backing of Western institutions are best. And there are many of those that can be exercised, and those which would be best would be those that would be created by the tribe or village, as Joe Yupikson pointed out, as John Borbridge pointed out. You take and use the tools, choose from the tools you have to satisfy the needs of the moment. And I think that, in essence, is why I am not particularly strong for IRAs.
Rosita, you had another question?
Oh, Chuck, yes, Chuck Smythe.
I have a question for Mr. Jones and Mr. Martin about subsistence. I'm recalling Mr. Jones's comment yesterday on the perception of subsistence among the staffers who were in Congress at the time. And I was wondering why, or if you can recall, why subsistence was deleted during markup from the House, from the Senate version of the bill, I believe. Whether there was any, you know, rationale behind that, or was it just a bargaining?
Well, I was thinking about that yesterday when Doug was speaking, and I tend to think that I probably associate myself a little bit more closely with the recollection that Dave Hickok had of that entire issue. That while it may be fair to say to some extent that